Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Shuttlepod at the Disco, where we look back at Discovery episodes that have just aired and talk about them right here on the Shuttlepod podcast. This is Shuttlepod at the Disco episode number 7, where we will be talking about Star Trek Discovery episode number 8, Si Vis Pacem, Parabellum. I'm your host, Kayla Iacovino, and I'm joined today by Matt Wright.
Hey.
And Jared Whitley.
Hello, everyone.
Hey, guys, good to have you back, Jared.
Thank you. It's good to be back. You guys did a great job last week.
Thank you.
I kept thinking, oh, gosh, I would say this right now, and then someone else said it as though reading my mind. So it was pleasant.
that's perfect. That's what I always think that I love listening to podcasts the most, when I'm just yelling at my radio or at my phone. Wishing I could be like, no, you're wrong, because this is what I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, those are my favorite podcasts to listen to. So I love when people tell us that they're, you know, yelling at their computers as they're listening to us.
Oh, and I do it when I'm not on and I'm listening to you guys, you know. I'm like, oh, come on, say that.
Usually you do,
of course, but then I'm like, oh, yeah, good. Like, but.
Well, before we get into talking about the episode today, I'm going to take this moment, as always, to remind everyone that the Shuttlepod podcast is brought to you by the humans at Bye Bye Robot, purveyors of fine art from the future. Bye Bye Robot sells officially licensed Star Trek art made by multiple artists in many different styles at prices starting around $25. Go to byebyerobot.com to learn more.
Good advice as always.
This is where Jared goes, that's a great idea, Kayla. I think everyone should do that after we talk about this next episode.
Let's go.
We look forward to a future where someday no one needs money. But until then, I'm spending mine at Bye Bye Robot.
Oh, good one.
Dang, that's good, Jared.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
But I think now we should talk about episode number 8, which I think I've said the episode title on this podcast twice now, and I've probably butchered it both times. Luckily for me, no one really knows how Latin is supposed to be pronounced. So I'm just going to go with Si Vis Pacem Parabellum, which, of course, is, as everybody knows, is Latin for if you want peace, prepare for war.
Mm.
This episode is written by Kirsten Baer and directed by David M. Barrett. I think it's worth mentioning that Kirsten Baer is a Star Trek novelist who has written a bunch of Star Trek Voyager novels and has become known as the quote-unquote keeper of the canon in the Star Trek Discovery writer's room.
So
this is her first writing credit on Discovery, is that correct?
Yeah, this is the first time she's written anything for TV.
Yeah, that's right. This was her first ever television screenplay, so... Especially given that, like, I think that's pretty impressive. But we can get into the details of that as we talk about the story. So why don't we just start off, as we usually do, with sort of brief initial reactions from you guys. So just to remind everyone, today is November 6th, Monday, and we all watched this episode yesterday, Sunday, November 5th. So Jared, why don't you tell us what you thought about Si Vis Pacem Parabellum.
Okay, so my main takeaway is, and I feel this consistently, I'm just so impressed with the quality of the production design, right? Whether it was the ship-to-ship battle in the beginning, or whether it was that kind of sort of tree of life, whatever type of thing on the planet. Just everything looks beautiful. You can tell there's so much care in it. I read this article a couple of years ago about special effects houses and how, even though technology keeps getting more advanced, sometimes it seems like special effects are getting worse because there's so many effects houses out there that a lot of times the way they make themselves competitive is by underbidding as much as possible. And computer animation is it's an art like anything else, and our good art generally takes time. And if you're underbidding, you're not paying people enough, you're not putting dedicating enough work hours into it, then even though technically you've got stronger, better, faster computers, you're getting worse output. But that doesn't seem to be the case with this at all. I feel like it's the first episode where we really go to a strange new world, and it looked terrific.
Yep.
So that's my main takeaway.
I'm in 100% agreement with with that point for sure. Matt, what do you think?
I really enjoyed it, but it was not as amazing as the hype had led us to believe, I will say. Mm. And that's one of those things that it's kind of unfair in a way, but we had heard repeatedly heard about this episode. And so it was kind of hard to live up to. And so it did. It was hard to live up to. And therefore, of course, it didn't really live up to it, which is kind of a bummer. It was really good. It just was not this like gangbusters amazing thing that we had been hearing since at least Star Trek Las Vegas. People have been talking about episode 8.
Wait, no,
so it's kind of hard.
I'm not aware of this. What specifically things have people been saying?
That this is a really amazing Saru episode, and that it's just like, you know, unparalleled kind of stuff. Like, people have been trumpeting it since they saw, you know, first draft scripts basically. So it's hard to live up to when you've been hearing for about how amazing episode 8 is and how, you know, and how deep it is about Saru and all this stuff. And it's like, okay, it's just hard to live up to, you know? Huh.
Okay. So yeah. I hadn't heard any of that at all.
So yeah. So people asked TLV if you were there the first day when they had the writers panel, you know, Kirsten Baer did not do this. It's other people gushing about her work. Of course, it was not her saying this.
Sure.
And so it was people like, Ted Sullivan, who was a great guy, but he was just gushing about it at a certain point. And we had recently, even on Twitter, David Mack, you know, the novelist, was, since he was let in on all these early draft scripts to write his book, he's read most of the first season as well. And so he was just like, oh, coming up is this amazing, you know, just amazing, amazing episode. I don't know how amazing it was. I think it was good. I don't know if it was like knock your socks off. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would agree with what both of you have said, pretty much everything. I think one of the strongest aspects was the visual design, the design of the planet, and the design of the Pavoans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember sitting there watching it and being like, oh, look, it's actually an alien planet. It's not either somewhere outside of Los Angeles or Vancouver, which is typically what you get in sci-fi shows. It's like either...
Or just a soundstage.
Or yep. Soundstage, yeah, or of course. Soundstage. But you know, if they're ever on location, it's either desert with shrubs or forest. And this one was forest, but at least we had like the blue leaves,
yeah,
and the cool lighting. And it was interesting. So that was cool. It was like, finally, we're exploring some strange new worlds.
Yeah, and that was very cool. It was but nice yeah, to see.
In terms of just like overall what I think about the episode, I very much liked it. I think I liked the last week's episode better.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The mud episode.
But again, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm coming down on this episode really at all. Just like you said, Matt, I liked it. But yeah, I did have some questions about some of it, which partly is good because it made me think, but partly I was a bit confused about some of it, I guess. So that's some of what I'd like to get into on this podcast.
Matt, were there any big top line changes that could have been made to have addressed your concerns? If there was one thing you could change, what would it be?
I think we'll start to sort of get into this more, but considering the way that everyone gushed about it being very Saru focused, I think they should have doubled down on that, because I was surprised at how light on Saru it really was. And what I mean is they said it was going to be this really, you know, good, poignant kind of deep dive into, like, you know, the sort of the why of Saru, right?
Yeah.
And it's there, but it's much more surface than I was expecting, right? And then the other thing that, just as an aside, both our compatriot Brian, who can't make it today, and I both thought about, was when we heard these things being described, we both totally expected to see at least somewhat some kind of flashback to Saru and his native planet. And then, you know, because the whole thing is, as he merges and becomes one with these Pavoans, like, we should see something of his past that motivates him, right? And we saw nothing of that.
See, I try not, as we talked before, I try not to watch the next episode, but I caught a little bit of it last week. And so I was going into this expecting that to be Saru's home planet.
Yep.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. I could see that
I
for sure.
I could see that, yeah. I only saw the first couple seconds of it as well, and then I turned it off. Yeah. So, but I saw them walking through a planet and something about Saru, and I was like, oh, yeah. So I could definitely see why you would think that.
Yeah.
So I think that's the main problem, is they really should have, I mean, we know this is supposed to be very Saru heavy, so then, yeah, let it be that. Like, go ahead, let it be that. And I know that they have to service all these other sort of plot lines, but it was a bummer that they did have to, in fact, you know?
So is that what the episode needed, was just to be more focused on this one storyline on the planet and have less of the stuff on the Discovery and on the...
I kind of think so.
What do you call it? Sarcophagus ship?
Yeah, I kind of think so.
I don't disagree with that outright, but I do have to say, I think maybe my favorite character in this episode for some reason was Cornwell.
Is that the Admiral lady?
The female Admiral.
Yeah. I liked what she did with the role a lot.
Because before I was like, I don't know, I was a little bit iffy about her, but I kind of really liked her character. I thought she was sympathetic and classy, and she seems to care about Lorca and in a real way. Like, she, you know, she, at one point she had a conversation with him after that briefing where he got mad at her, and she was like, well, I didn't want to make you look like too much of an asshole, so I left this part out, but we do need to talk about it. It was like a little thing of like, that's what a real friend would actually do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I didn't bring this up during our meeting, but, you know, I don't know. And it seems like she really cares about him. So I was starting to like her already. And then, yeah. I don't know, I was just like, at the end of this episode, I was like, she's my favorite character now. Like, when she screams at Laurel, I was like, yes. Like, that's how you get a Klingon to respect you.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a really awesome moment.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's not putting up with it.
Now, what do we think about that exchange with the Klingon who... seem to be going turncoat.
Yeah, do we want to dive into that right now? It's a little bit out of order, but I'm fine with it.
Laurel playing both sides, basically.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Let's talk about it.
So there's we have a couple options. One, we can take what she said at face value, that she really wanted to defect, or two, that it was like a plan to try to trick Admiral Cornwall.
Yeah, well, considering she's from a house of, like, spies and deceivers, I don't think what she's saying should be taken at face value, no.
I think she's clearly not wanting to defect, because she is a religious zealot. I mean, you look at her a couple episodes ago, you know, she's, like, essentially holding to Kuvma as a martyr.
Sure.
And believes in this religious movement of Remain Klingon and all this stuff. So, you know, the idea that she would give that up is... seems ridiculous, but it's clear that she hates Cole.
Yeah.
So that part I believe. I believe that she wants to screw him over and that she thinks he's a worthless Patak.
Yep.
Well done. Hey, watch your language. This is a family podcast.
sorry. Yeah. We get one Patak per episode. Oh, sorry, that was two.
That's okay. Uh-oh. That's next week's.
You've hit your quota. Yeah.
Okay, so she genuinely did want the defect, but not because she wants, you know, to side with the humans.
No, I don't think she wants revenge.
Yeah, I don't think she wants to defect. I think she wants to get onto the Discovery for herself.
Yes, because you'll note that she very clearly said, oh, I want your ship. That was the Discovery, right? Like, she goes, you were from the Discovery, right?
Yeah. And
specifically wants that ship by name. So, yeah, I think she wants the spore drive tech because while Cole has, you know, the cloaking tech that he's sort of dangling over people's heads and using... to amass, you know, support. So, well, what's the only other thing left, right? What's the other thing left that you could dangle over people's heads and sort of, you know, use as a carrot? Well, yeah. That's the spore drive, because that's what's keeping the Federation like, in the war.
Right? Yeah, so if you had both the spore drive and a cloak, then you'd be doing pretty
well.
You're
unstoppable. Yeah.
And there's two parts to this story, right, about Laurel wanting to get onto Discovery. If a certain fan theory is to be believed.
Mm.
There is something else waiting for her on Discovery.
Indeed.
I don't know if I should say any more for anyone who doesn't want to get into the fan theory stuff for risk of any potential spoilers.
Sure.
But, if you've read our fan theory articles on Trek Movie, then you're well aware of what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A love triangle built for four.
Yeah. Yep. There you go.
Yes,
so,
indeed.
You know, that's what was in my mind the whole time. I was like, she wants to get she wants to get back to that. Yeah. And it seems like the discovery, if that theory is to be believed, then the discovery is probably pretty central in the whole plot in general. Yep. So.
Yep. Good point.
I feel like we have to, if we're going to be talking about this moment before we move on, I think we have to talk about Admiral Cornwell. And is she dead?
Oh, yeah. She looked pretty dead.
I don't think she's dead.
So I don't want her to be, because as you said, she's become a really great character.
I don't think she is.
If that's a fake out. I'd like it
I
to be
a fake,
fake
out.
Out.
I think but it's we'll a see. Huge fake out.
I hope
out.
It is.
Well, they were either doing the thing of make her, you really like her, and then kill her off for emotional, you know, some cheap emotional response.
Yeah.
I don't think they were doing that, though, because they explicitly didn't show anything that's like, you know, usually like they fall on the ground and then like a little blood comes out the mouth.
Yeah.
Or you see them twitch and then fall, you know.
Yeah, she was like, not disemboweled like many other Klingon victims.
She almost looked like she was just electrocuted or something, or like knocked unconscious,
like stunned.
and she's being dragged, and usually if she was dead there'd be like a blood trail, you know what I mean? There wasn't any of these little things that they usually used to tell the audience, oh yeah, she like she's so dead, like they didn't use those, and they kind of just left her in this room. So I think that she's just unconscious and that she's gonna come back later.
Yeah, especially because she chose that room purposely, because that's the room piled up with bodies, because remember, most Klingons don't give a crap about the empty shell that's left behind.
Yeah.
But her sect does. Mm. And so Kull sure doesn't. So he just piles them in there, right? So she knows that no one cares to go in there because they don't care about, you know, what the empty shell once they're dead. Mm-hmm. So she could definitely be stashing her there to sort of wake up later. You know?
Sure.
Yeah.
It kind of reminded me a little bit of that scene in Galaxy Quest where Alan Rickman and Tim Allen pretend to be in a fight to trick the aliens, right? Mm-hmm. They weren't really like trying to kill each other. They just did that to distract them. Because you'll notice there's that bit where the one guard is going to shoot him. And then when he sees, like, he wants to see how the fight turns out. So he makes him lower his weapon.
Yep. Definitely.
Love that movie.
It's the best.
All right. So let's talk about the Pavoans a bit, and just the planet Pavo. Mm-hmm. I'm looking over our show notes here, and I like very much like the first point on this list about Pavo, which is just simply says Pavo equals Pandora ?
Well, you have to admit, especially that since they went with the blue tint most of the world, they kind of invited that
and the big central tree.
Yep. And the whole life force thing that, you know, it turns out to be sentient, sort of, is kind of related to. Not quite, but similar.
Did anyone else get a upside down, like Stranger Things, the upside down feel when Saru's laying on the ground and you see all the little, like, whatever, light things floating through the air?
Oh, mm-hmm. No, sure. I didn't, but I see what you mean.
I've just been watching Stranger Things, too, so I was like, oh no, they're in the upside down. There's floating things.
Lots of people, I think, have remarked on that. I think it's kind of true. It's got that vibe, freaky little vibe.
So what do you guys think about the MacGuffin of the episode, which is this magical crystalline tower that they were going to use to send a signal which would let them detect cloaked ships or reveal cloaked ships?
Yeah it's weird. It's kind of like a sonar for the cloak, you know?
Yeah, that seemed reasonable,
and I was like, okay, I could sort of buy that. I don't know. It's one of those things where it's like, all right, I guess I can buy that, but we'd have to see it in use, you know, like in practice. I think the bigger question that we've talked about it a little bit on Slack and whatnot is that there's a weird kind of situation with this and the Prime Directive, because, well, they thought they were beaming down to an empty planet just with like the resources that they need, right? This unique resource. And then, of course, it turns out that, well, no, not quite. The whole planet is sort of sentient. We're not entirely sure. Like, it's not clear at all if there's like a group of, you know, beings, or if this is sort of like the planet itself.
Yeah.
Is kind of
like born. a uni-mind type of thing.
Yeah.
It's both, right? I think there are these beings that live on the planet, but they also kind of are the planet.
Well, but is there one, like Jared said, is there sort of a one mind thing, or do they actually have individual, like, ideas of, you know, individual sort of differences?
Sure.
Or like, not a, really sure. Like a great link type of thing where they can all join together.
Right.
So yeah, that's kind of what I imagined, I guess. But yeah, we don't know.
But we actually don't know. It could just be sort of like one manifestation, right? Like one being, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It's never clear, and that's okay. It doesn't have to be clear, but it's an interesting thought. Right,
right. Yeah, so, it's a very cool idea.
So whom, whether it's plural or not, the Pavoans, like whether plural is appropriate to use or not, because we don't know. Then it becomes the whole thing where, well, there's certainly a sentience here, so we've got to talk to them and tell them like we would like to use their resources. So it's interesting because you've basically blown through, because you can't go back. So you've basically blown through maybe observing a culture discreetly because, well, you landed there thinking no one was there and the entire planet has already felt you.
So you're already involved without even trying.
Yeah. Right, yeah. You're already involved without even trying. So now, as both Burnham and Saru say, well, now it's a first contact situation, right? Because here you are, and the planet knows you exist now. So
yeah, I totally bought that.
Yeah, I thought so. It's just fine. Interesting. Just kind of interesting because it's like, okay, well, I guess you have no choice, right? You better make a first contact because they already know you exist. Like the planet has sort of sensed you're here. So
yeah, and honestly, I mean, I think you know. Hindsight is 2020. So looking back at the way, for example, Saru and Tyler were acting, you know, Tyler was all suspicious. Can we really trust them? Blah, blah, blah. And mm-hmm. Saru is just like, oh, hello. No, this is first contact. Everything's fine. Like, watch and learn, guys. Oh, hello. My name is Saru. Mm-hmm. Let's just bond with you real quick.
Yeah.
It seems like he was acting foolish, but as I was watching it, and even I was thinking in the back of my mind, this is going to come back to bite him.
Yeah.
Because there's one guy being like, are you sure? You know, and he's being all nice. But I'm like, I think that's the right approach, is to assume benevolence in the first place. And then, because you don't want to go acting all super suspicious of every new species you meet and like holding up your guns in defense and everything. So,
and that's certainly the Starfleet we know, which is to be optimistic and assume hostile first
to extend the hand of friendship.
Yeah. Exactly. So I thought at least in the beginning of the episode, I was all for what Saru was doing.
Yeah.
And the way he approached it, I thought it was great actually.
Mm-hmm. I also think he, I don't know if ego is the right word, but he kind of wants to prove himself to Michael Burnham, like,
yeah,
does that make sense?
Oh yeah, oh absolutely, definitely, because that goes back to that sibling thing that they had.
Yeah, yeah. Totally.
He wants to show I am in command here, young lady, not you.
And I know what I'm doing. Yeah.
He and still I will has a commission.
Kick you in the chest with my ridiculously long legs if you talk back to me.
That's right. Yeah.
All right, so. Let's talk about Saru going native a bit, because this is really the heart of the episode,
right?
Is this transition and the consequences of it. And it's the part I have to admit I struggle with it a little bit.
Yeah. And this is the part again, this goes back to this is the area that we heard hyped a lot. So this is the hardest part to live up to.
That's true.
Coming back to that.
You know, here's the thing for me. Because at the end of the episode, they pretty much establish Saru was not under any kind of mind control. He wasn't acting even in the wishes of the Pavoans, you know, because
that's right.
You know, like they weren't telling him what to do and they weren't influencing him in any way to do the things he was doing. So, you know.
Well, at first we're led to believe that he is being influenced, right?
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely...
The twist is that he's not.
The twist is that he's not, but that has some pretty major implications. Like, I know Michael says, you weren't yourself, but no, he was himself.
So, you know, a lot of this in a way reminds me of... Kayla, you'll like this since you like the movie. A lot of this actually reminds me of the way people, like the Elorians describe being in the ribbon, right? Being in the Nexus.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And then being ripped away from it, right? Is he was in this place of kind of perfection, and then he's being told to leave it, right?
Yeah.
And some people don't want to do that more than others, let's say. So you could see it. Like you
I get that. But, well, there's two things for me. So first of all, I think his reaction was very extreme. And if he really is going to react to loss in that way, then maybe he shouldn't be in a command position. Because you know, like he's been through a serious trauma, first of all. So he needs counseling for this. And, you know, second of all, you know, if he, some, yes, there are other people in the ribbon and they didn't all go crazy and make a giant rocket to destroy his son, you know, only one of them right. did. Right. So if he's going to react in this way, we have to question how he's going to be able to react to other things. And the other thing,
definitely.
Here's the real sticking point for me though, is that supposedly he wanted to stay on the planet because he experienced no fear for the first time in his life. But in my opinion, his actions were completely motivated by fear, by a heightened sense of fear of having to leave that planet.
Yeah.
To well, me, that's I right. That's exactly right.
Yeah, he's... I can't understand any other emotion that could have been driving his actions besides extreme unadulterated fear.
But that's it exactly. I think you're exactly right, which is that it's the fear of loss. And in this case, it's the loss of feeling loss, right? It's like you're not supposed to be able to feel that anymore. He feels very at peace. And so suddenly, if you're going to rip that away from him, he's going to go into the fight or flight mode. And as we know, that's what he does, like, you know, inherently. So he goes into fight mode, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I guess so. So it was really just one moment of fearlessness that he was fighting for, is what you're saying.
I think when he was merged with them, like, he felt pretty good. You know what I mean?
But he was completely fearful. You know what I mean? So it just seems a little...
Well, I think it's kind of like the spores in This Side of Paradise, where you can snap out of it with a certain emotion, right?
Uh-huh.
I think it's in that same vein of, yeah, everything's pretty groovy until you're slapped upside the head with a negative emotion, right? It's like, oh, you're going to rip this away from me. No, you know, nope, I'm not going to put up with this.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. Yeah. See, although
it's unclear, like you said, it's unclear.
The spores left me with a feeling of these people were being controlled and they couldn't be held 100% accountable. But yeah. In this case, I just feel like the way it was left at the end is that Saru should be held 100% accountable. And he did, like, basically try to kill Michael.
Yeah, and he says as much and he feels pretty terrible for it.
Like, I kind of think he should.
He should, yeah. And hopefully, of course, this is one of those unspoken things, to go back to what you were saying, is hopefully he's sitting there in sickbay seriously thinking about whether he can actually command, like you were saying, because of this, you know, huge, huge reaction he had. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, yeah, can I be objective, right, in command?
Yeah.
So hopefully he's thinking, I mean, we don't know, but hopefully he's thinking these things.
It just seems like he committed some pretty serious acts, and it seems like people around him are willing to give him more of a free pass than like when we've seen, you know, we saw what Burnham did, for example, in the pilot. Mm-hmm. And yeah, obviously, you know, she overthrew her captain and did all these horrible things and ended up, well, some people could say she started the war, some people will say she didn't, but you know, the motivations were pure, and if you can understand what she's going through and blah blah blah. And I feel like you can make similar arguments for what she did and compare it to what Saru did in this episode, and it feels like Saru is left with zero punishment or zero consequences, I guess.
Well, we don't know that. I mean, once he gets better, he might be demoted. He might be removed as first officer and someone gets put in his place.
Maybe, yeah. But I just don't
he
see that happening.
Yeah,
I think he
I don't
should
see
be
that
too. But
he should be, yeah.
And it's like Burnham gets imprisonment for life.
For life.
Yeah.
You know, so
way
just,
harsh.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It seems a bit unfair.
Good points, for sure.
Okay,
so
moving on.
So how about, there's one member of the landing party that we haven't talked about very much yet, which is Lieutenant Ash Tyler.
Ah, yes. Mr. wants to go have a lake house and fish when he's done with the war.
Yeah. Mr. like kind of felt like a third wheel on this mission.
Boy, huh? Yeah. Because that sibling sort of relationship between Burnham and Saru left him just sort of out.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So I wrote this note, so I think I'll take it, which is that I think they tried way too hard to force the nice Burnham and Tyler kind of chemistry. I don't think they had a lot of chemistry in this episode, quite frankly, which is weird because they did a really great job and had really good chemistry in the last episode. And I think they kind of felt that they'd better do something with it, since we saw it happen, well, again and again and again in the last episode, right? And every time a lot of their progress was reset. So that kiss that they had in the last episode, of course, was erased, right? So I just feel like they were doing the kitchen sink thing. And it's like, well, we better kind of talk about this plot line. And we should really have them have their real first kiss because the last one was, you know, erased.
Right.
So let's have a weird little campfire-like moment.
Like that was like a box to tick, like romance scene.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Exactly. It's just like, let's just check this off. Like they're supposed to, they have a moment. Oh, okay, well, let's give them another moment since the last one was taken back, right? Was reset. And it's like, I don't know. It felt a little forced, but I don't know what you guys think.
Did we like or did we not like the callback to the Kirk Spock quote about the needs of the many?
I didn't like it.
I had a feeling you weren't going to like it,
Jim. Yeah.
A lot of it's pretty polarizing. I didn't hate it. I thought it was kind of cute, but
also to interject in the fourth season of Enterprise, they retcon that line to have been like a word of wisdom from Surak, right? And so it wasn't that Spock came up with that line. It's in Wrath of Khan, he was quoting Surak.
Sure.
So which makes now sense, by the way. Michael was doing the same thing. So she's not reading, you know, seeing 25 years into the future.
No.
Right. No, that makes it a lot better, I think. And yeah, I think I'm with you, Matt. I didn't hate it, but I could see why some people would.
Yeah, it was a little too cute. Like
it came that. Very close to not falling well. It was like exactly. It's like the Khan scream in Into Darkness, which did not land.
Nothing tops that.
No. Did not land. No, that. But it's the same idea, right? Like that could have. Right, they could have made that work. Maybe there's a universe, and you know, I like to always say it. There is a universe in which that line lands in the movie. There are infinite universes. But it, you know, it is, I think it is possible to do something like that and to have it work. And I think this one was like on the border of it working. For me, it just falls to the left of that border where it just barely works. But I could very easily see people being like, nah, that didn't work for me. Cause it could pull you out of the story.
Mm-hmm. Agree.
It seemed unnecessary.
Yeah.
I thought it was slightly cute. I'm going to admit
okay,
it.
You liked it. Okay, that's fine.
Slightly cute. I did like saying, or the one, along with Burnham as she said it.
That's hilarious. Oh, Kayla, you're right there with your girlfriend. You go, girl.
You go, Michael. Although, you know, I'm still dubious of this new boy in her life.
Well, yeah. They keep giving hints that maybe so, you know.
Like, they're setting us up for failure.
Yeah,
like,
why is
Laurel? Why does Laurel want to get to the Discovery so bad, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Before we leave the planet Pavo, I want to talk about sort of where this leaves us for the end of the episode, which is that apparently the Pavans are so into peace and harmony, they don't really understand like what conflict is, sort of. And it seems kind of, at least from our perspective, it seems like they naively actually changed the transmission to call the Klingons to them to see if, I don't know, I guess if they could be some sort of peacekeeper, you know, peace brokers. We don't really know, of course. That's what we're waiting to find out next week. But, like, what?
Okay, so now I, this may be contradicting what I just said, but I felt that this was like a callback to the Organian intervention in Errand of Mercy.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
And
absolutely.
So,
which actually worries me a little.
Why does that worry you?
Think? Well, because it almost feels like a little bit too much of a ripoff. And remember, the Organian thing is going to happen in 11 years from now anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. Anyway, go ahead.
So is there... See, cause the thing is... and this has always been where the 25-year allegory in Star Trek to the Cold War kind of fell flat, is the reasons that the U.S. and the Soviets never went to war was because of mutually assured destruction, right? Because we had weapons of mass destruction. And that's never established in Star Trek. It's never that the Klingons and the Federation have these mega weapons, and if we use them, we can't use them, right? So we have to only fight little brush fires like a private little war. We can't actually go to conflict. And so the replacement for that is the Organian intervention, and that's always felt a little off to me, as much as I love that episode. So if they are able to do something here that kind of sets that up, to kind of patch that over, I will be more pleased with it. But that may just be me.
Interesting. No, you have a good point. We'll have to see how it goes, because I just don't know where they're going to take this, obviously.
Yeah, we'll find out.
So how do we feel about this cliffhanger then? Because they brought the Klingons. Everyone's beaming in to say hello. And then next time on Star Trek Discovery, you know, that's the end of the episode. So they're going to leave us hanging. And I think it's worth pointing out that this episode was originally supposed to be the final episode in the first half of season one.
Oh, so I didn't realize that.
Yes.
This was going to be our mid-season finale until they changed it. And now we have next week is the mid-season
finale. And that was a very smart choice, because leaving it this way is very hollow and amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the first thing I thought when the episode ended was, wow, I'm glad this wasn't the last episode of this part of the season.
I thought the exact same thing. I was like, oh, this is episode 8. This is where it was originally going to end. Wow. You know, just I'm glad they didn't.
I think they thought we'll leave it on a cliffhanger, like because this feels like a two-parter.
Yeah.
Oh, it totally is. Yeah.
But the two-parter aspect of it is related to this. It's rather episodic, and so it doesn't have a lot of weight for the rest of the arc. The actual cliffhanger itself is just like, well, we don't know what's going to happen next, so that's exciting, so it's a cliffhanger. But it's not like this could change, this one encounter could change all of these different storylines that were hanging in the air. So I just felt like it wasn't weighty enough to be a cliffhanger for that.
Definitely. To go along with the feeling it's very much like part one of two, which it totally is the fact that this is one of the shortest episodes of Discovery yet. And I don't know why exactly, especially when we found out that there was a couple of deleted scenes talked about on After Trek. They should have left them in, because it was more between Laurel and the Admiral, they had awesome chemistry together as, you know, actors, right? It was really good. I don't know why they cut it. This is the shortest episode so far.
But, you know, they probably, my guess is they didn't really cut it for time. They probably cut it because they felt it didn't work. And if that's the case, then I agree with that.
That's fine. But, it just feels short, because it's like, oh, we're going to set you up for this. And now, you know, next week. Sorry.
Yeah.
So it just feels that way. This is very much a feeling of that, which is too bad. Yeah.
Let's talk about the Stamets side story real quick, because that was a small part of this episode, but I think it's an important part in his arc.
Yeah.
It's another thing to check the box, too. He's had another story, to go back to the storyline of all the arcs we have to talk about.
How many of these threads can we weave in?
It's another box to check. Like, let's check in on Stamets.
But I'm partly okay with that, because I like that there are a lot of threads hanging, and it's nice to see them moving along.
Sure. But again, I feel like it distracted from this in-depth look at Saru we were supposed to get.
Okay.
It didn't happen.
I also liked that they answered the most obvious question, which is, why wouldn't why wouldn't he tell the ship's medical officer what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was also his boyfriend, so that's a dual relationship there.
Well, but I mean, he doesn't even introduce that. He says, you know, if I tell him, I could get him in trouble, right? And so it makes, I mean, it's like every part of a horror movie where you're like, no, just do this, right? And so we may be saying in the audience, no, you have to do this, and he's explaining why he doesn't. So I thought that worked pretty well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I agree. I liked it. I talked to a friend who said that he didn't buy that explanation at all, but I was like, I totally did. Well, like, it happens all the time where you're in some weird situation at work or something where you, you know, you can't. You'd rather ask for forgiveness than permission, for example, because if you ask for permission and they say no, then you know what I mean. So it's like. Yeah, and that's it. So,
and as Stamets points out, of course, this DNA tampering thing is a huge no-no, right? Like, because of you know, the eugenics wars and all this stuff, at least humans in the Federation, like the human side, you know, Terrans have at least decided that, you know, DNA tampering is a huge, like, no-no. So if he reports that, well, they're obligated to file reports, right, with like Starfleet Security or somebody, and be like, well, look what's going on, right? So, yeah, he really can't. It's the whole beg forgiveness later thing. Like, too bad we needed the spore drive to work to win this war. I can apologize later. You know. I also really like that it was, of course, of our kind of bubbly heart and soul of the crew, I feel like, at this point. Tilly was having the conversation with him, which I thought was really nice.
Also, did anyone think it was really interesting when he comes and he calls her captain when he comes out of the
yes mirror. Yeah. Oh, we should talk about that.
As if he's seeing that. Like another timeline,
like
or another
the mirror
place.
Universe. Tilly is the in captain. The,
yeah, either mirror right. universe or yeah another universe or subspace domain or another place in the time space time yeah. continuum.
Oh, like
maybe
he's
jumping
he's
around
into
in this
the
universe,
future.
But
jumping
yeah,
around because remember yeah. Tilly's declared she's going to become a captain one day. Uh-huh. Right? She said this like she's ambitious. I thought that
and,
was great.
And he said, "When I come back." Things that I know have changed.
Yep.
So he's seeing different universes or different times or different places and being integrated in his mind into those places, into those existences, and then
this
coming
poor guy,
back.
I tell you, that poor guy, he must be both exhausted and on the verge of a breakdown, I'm sure, at some point soon because of all these probabilities stuck in his head, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think we're probably going to see that come to a head at some point. Maybe next episode.
Seems soon, yeah. So, yeah, but I did like that it was Tilly who just basically calls him out in a good way, though, in a caring way, and says, well, okay, what is going on, you know? And then, of course, and this is her boss, right? So she's intimidated quite a bit by him, although, of course, his personality shifts have made it a little better until suddenly it's not, right? Suddenly uh-huh. in this episode, he's back to being quite the jerk about things. And so... But it was cool, and it was nice of her to just like call him out and then say, yeah, but I'm here for you, and I'll track, you know, I'll keep track of what's yeah. going on. Like, we can keep a private log of your changes. So it was a good little side, you know, thread of his.
Yeah, I felt so too. So were there any other random bits, little moments that you guys wanted to mention? There was one that I had that I just wanted to shout out to the shout out in this episode. We, the very beginning of the episode, we saw the USS Gagarin, which is very probably named for Yuri Gagarin, who was the first man in space. He was a Russian cosmonaut.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that I assume it was Matt that noted this, that both Enterprise and Star Trek Beyond also played homage to him, naming the Gagarin radiation belt after him. Mm-hmm. And beyond, the USS Franklin got lost in the radiation belt and then ended yep. up on Ultimate. So.
Yep. So it's funny that it's taken, there's a throwaway mention in Enterprise of the same radiation belt that they talk about in Beyond.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's taken quite a while for, it's actually pretty shameful, really, that it's taken this long for us being, you know, Trek, like for Trek to actually give this guy a ship, because he absolutely should have had a ship named for him. At this point, right? It's a huge deal. He's the first human to go into space.
Mm-hmm.
But it was cool that they did that. It was a nice throw out. It was like, hey.
Yeah, that was good.
Yep. Happy to see it.
So the point that I wanted to mention is I really appreciate that they're taking their time revealing details of the ship and the crew. It's not like in the pilot, they didn't just info dump everything. Like the thing I keep thinking, and I may have said this already, I keep thinking about that line in Emissary where they realize the wormhole is there and Odo has to stop and quickly give his backstory in one paragraph or less and say, that was where I was found. I have to go explore there. And it's like there's that robot on the bridge and they haven't explained anything about him at all. Right. And I appreciate that it's just there's a robot there. We'll find out eventually. But I appreciate so much that there has been no line like, yes, I am a prototype android. I predict that someday there will be more fully functional androids. But for now, I will fill just the function I have done. It may take a generation or two. You know, like that. I don't want to hear that.
Yeah. Totally. That's a good point. And that's hard to do in television shows in the first season and certainly in the first half of the first season. It's I think it's difficult to resist that urge to do that. Read us your character description. Read that for the audience if you would.
Because the thing is, historically TV was kind of like comic books where it's this open-ended long-form narrative where the beginning to every story is whatever the origin story is, and then there's no end in sight. And so it's like, if you pick up Spider-Man comic book, all you need to know is he got bit by a radioactive spider, he'll never die, and then you're just reading whatever's happening this month, right? And it's kind of the same way episodic TV was. It's like, you just have to know whatever's in the show Bible that was in the pilot, And doesn't matter what happened last week, doesn't matter what happened next week. You just need to know that one thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
And definitely. So that they have a little bit more space to breathe is great.
So overall, where do you guys put this episode, Discovery episode number 8, in terms of, in comparison with the rest of the first half of season 1?
It's sort of the upper level of the middle of the pack, you know what I mean? Like, it's towards the top. It's an awkward thing to say. I don't know what you want to call it.
He's upper, middle, lower class.
Yes, exactly. He's totally.
Yeah, this is, for me, this is solidly bourgeoisie. it is the upper middle class for me. And I think it's one of the best episodes of the season, but not my favorite. I think last week's episode number 7, was probably my favorite.
It's hard to top that one. So just fun. Pure sort of fun.
Yeah, but this had a lot of great elements in it. I thought the storytelling was good. I thought the production design was fantastic, as both of you guys mentioned. And they did a lot of really, really cool things with this episode. So yeah, I think it's solidly one of the better episodes of Discovery that we've seen so far. But yeah, not my favorite.
Yeah, but on the production design sort of thing, before we sort of leave and wrap up, I wanted to point out something really cool from the sound effect design. And I totally locked into this instantly. And I know other people have too, because I've seen it in the comments. Saru, when he was trying to sleep, and he starts to get overwhelmed by the sounds of the planet. It is, you guys totally go back and listen to it if you didn't notice it. It is absolutely mixed into this is the original transporter sound effects from the Cage era. The Cage era sound effects were much more powerful sounding and really kind of throbby. And, you know, this is the era when you needed two people to manipulate, you know, the transporter, that kind of thing. It was supposed to be really powerful and crazy. And so somebody totally dug this out of the sound effects library and mixed it in to the sort of cacophony of stuff that's hounding Saru. I noticed it right away and was like, well, that's a really cool use for an old sound effect, especially one that's actually from that's sort of right from the correct era in a way, like they mixed it in, you know.
Good ears.
So why don't we go ahead and play these sounds for listeners, and then they can hear for themselves the comparison. So here's the original sound. And then here is the sound effects from when Saru is trying to sleep in the last episode. So yeah, like a pretty good match.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Well, thanks for adding a multimedia component to the shuttle pod, Killer.
Yeah. Good call.
Yeah. Anytime.
All right. Do we have any final thoughts before we tune out?
I think it's hard to not just think ahead to the next episode. I mean, it was such a cliffhanger-y. It was such a classic two-parter cliffhanger. I kind of liked that about it. It's like, here come the Klingons. Dun, 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 dun. You know, wait to find out the exciting conclusion next week.
Yeah.
I liked that.
Thank goodness there is a next week and they're not making us wait till January.
Yeah. Because that's a long time to wait for a conclusion of that magnitude. So.
Yeah.
So next week's episode, which will be released on November 12th in the U.S. and Canada, is episode number 9, Into the Forest I Go. So what might happen, you guys, in episode number 9? Remember, this is the last one before the fall hiatus. Like, so what things do they have to dangle in front of us or give us any resolution to before we go on break for a couple of months?
Well, I think we have to see a lot more of conflict with the Klingons, because there's been a lot of telling, not showing with that lately, I feel like.
Mm.
So I'd like to see that come to a head, and then they can leave us until January. You know what I mean? Like, I'd like to see that get pretty desperate, maybe, and then we'll have a nice real kind of note to go out on, you know, leave us wanting more.
Totally. How about you, Jared?
Okay, so I'm looking at our show notes, and I think we have a typo, because you have Forrest spelled with two R's.
Yes.
And so I looked at that, and I thought, Admiral Forrest from Enterprise is going to come save the day.
He's dead. He dead, though.
I know, but every true Star Trek fan has a soft spot in their heart for Vaughn Armstrong. So if they can bring him back in any way, they got to do it.
Yeah, he's one of the few people who's played like tons of characters in almost every
iteration. He has played more different characters in Star Trek than anyone else.
Yeah, kind of amazing.
Hashtag bring back Vaughn.
There we go. Yeah.
Get it trending, people. Get it trending. Those always work.
Always. Hashtags. Every single time.
Always. Sure.
Yeah. Also, change.org petitions. Those always work.
Totally.
Hey, well.
You could probably cut that part. We're going to get trouble for that.
I like the contempt in Kayla's voice right there.
That was very, yeah. People who think Discovery sucks. What?
Someone's probably started a change.org petition to ban Discovery because they hate it.
Oh, they have, like, I'm sure.
Yeah.
No doubt. No doubt.
Well, we should start a petition to ban petitions banning Star Trek Discovery.
I would sign that petition.
Yeah.
I would sign it. With three different fake names.
Oh, there we go, at least. Well, thanks for joining us, the Shuttle Pod at the Disco. We appreciate that you coming with us every week. We look forward to seeing you next week. Farewell.
Bye, guys. See you next week.
Bye, everybody.